This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Lazy CEO Podcast. I'm Jane Liu. Join my conversations with the entrepreneurs behind the iconic brands we all know and love.
Hey, Potty Fam. So excited about this next guest because it's someone who I saw on stage when I just started Shopo and I was like, wow. It's none other than Ruslan Kogan, the founder of Kogan, one of Australia's largest online retailers, known mostly for their electronics and white goods and pretty much everything. Started back in 2006, Kogan saw an arbitrage opportunity to sell flat screens at a much lower price by using a pre-sale model. So, Ruslan ordered a bunch of TVs, listed them on eBay at a 1 cent starting point with no reserve, and to no surprise, they sold like hotcakes, and Kogan.com was born. In 2016, Kogan listed on the Australian Stock Exchange, and at its peak, reached a market capitalization of $2.6 billion. And today, Kogan sells over 50 million products on its site to over 3 million active customers and makes over $1 billion in sales annually. Such an interesting chat because we have quite similar backgrounds and I really resonate with so much of his business principles. This man is a genius and you're going to love this. So let's get into it. Hello, Potty Fam. I have a very exciting guest today. It's Ruslan Kogan. Said it wrong. I was like, don't say it. Ruslan.
That's very, very maybe the average of the two. Yeah. You're there. That's quite so Ruslan. But my mum says it wrong sometimes.
Okay. This is such an amazing moment for me because you're the one person I really remember when I was starting Shopo, hearing you on stage and being like, oh my God, everything you were saying was resonating with me so much. So you're like the most memorable speaker I've heard. So now to get you into the podcast room, this is a very exciting moment for me.
An absolute pleasure. And thank you for inviting me. I do remember us being the OGs of e-commerce back in the day. The entrepreneur environment's changed over time. Like when we did it, we had to hustle, be profitable from day one, make ends meet, solve everything from first principles. Then we've sort of had a generation where you make a PDF presentation and you raise 100 mil.
Yeah.
We sort of went through that over the last year. So things have sort of changed over time. Now it's reverting back to the mean.
It happened. Yeah. You have such an incredible story of launching that people these days might not even understand. Like, well, why don't you just open a Shopify account? And why don't you just do this? It was a different time. And you really had to think outside the box and you really had to like hustle.
But that's, I guess, why we got to where we did and started.
Exactly.
We had that first mover advantage. We were doing it before others, before e-commerce was a thing. Like it's when all the major retailers in the country were talking about how, oh, well, it's a fad and the internet's not really real. It's not here to stay.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant sales and so on. And luckily, we're now at a time when everyone's like, hey, the internet is real.
You're from Belarus and you moved when you were 6. I came from China when I was 8. Tell me what it was like immigrating here.
Well, for me as a child, it was like, hey, everything was great. My parents were always present. We had enormous amount of love in the house. So it's like, I guess you don't know what you don't know. So ignorance is sort of bliss, because they came here with $90 in their pocket. We lived in the housing commission flats.
Wow.
They were working 3 to 4 jobs each. Even while doing that, my mum never missed a parent-teacher interview. She even now can recall the names of every single teacher I had through primary school and high school and so on. So a very loving house, growing up in the housing commission flats, lots of kids to play with, because you walk outside and there's lots of people playing and climbing trees and jumping fences and stuff all the time. So lots of stuff to do as a kid. But now that you mature and you think back at the time, and, you know, it was a difficult period for my parents. You arrive with $90 in a country where you don't speak the language, you don't know anything, you're trying to make ends meet, and it's go, go, go. Provide for your kids, support your kids, and build a new life. So I watched my parents, you know, my mum being a waitress at one cafe, cleaner at another, studying English at the same time, my dad delivering pizzas and working at the Victoria Market, then being a taxi driver, and watching them work 3 to 4 jobs a day each. And you realize later on in life how much you learn from that, and that work ethic and the risk-taking that they did. And you also realize that while, you know, both our parents came from a communist country, and communism doesn't teach you too many great things about business, we learned the most important business skills from our parents. If you think about what it takes to be an immigrant, it's almost identical to what it takes to be an entrepreneur. You've got to drop everything you've got, take a massive risk, travel into the unknown, and work your butt off for a potential benefit that might not even be there. And we've seen our parents go through that. And then you go, oh, well, seeing them do that was the best business skills I could ever learn.
And you don't realize at the time, when you look back, it's like we're more okay with being uncomfortable, more okay with being out of our comfort zone, and having that determination of like, okay, we're just going to make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that determination is very important. And it's something, you know, we're both parents now, and it's something I think about all the time. Like, just growing up with that hunger, that determination, the discomfort is something that we'll have a battle for our kids to make sure that they feel a bit of that as well in order to drive them forward.
I told my startup story about like how I had to like pretend to go to work because my parents, I couldn't tell them that I had quit my corporate job. And then everyone, when it's like a public speaking and there's a Q&A afterwards, their first question is like, what's the first thing that they say? And like, well, they're like, how did you have the balls to do this? Like, they didn't say balls. How did you, like, we're not an entrepreneurial family. How did you have the risk to be able to do this? And I was like, well, when they first asked me, I said, you took so many risks. You left everything you knew and you worked your butt off. And I actually now, in my mind, I just realized, I think I got that from listening to your speech all those years ago. I don't think I was that wise then. It's flooding back.
And the other thing is that could have helped that is we grew up in loving homes and loving families. Mm-hmm. And it gives you that safety blanket to start a business, because when I used to have a lot more time to speak at the entrepreneur conferences and tell the story, and you'd have people come up to you afterwards and go, oh, you took those risks. I could never imagine, like, you love a risk and that's why you managed to build a business. It's like the risks I took were fairly irrelevant. Like, if everything fell apart, I still had a bed at home. Yeah. I would have had food on the table. Nothing changed. Like, yeah, I just would have had I tried a business that failed.
Yeah. And then you were unemployed for a little bit.
Yeah, but it's like no big deal. It's like the employment was almost irrelevant. It's like I still could live in the bedroom in my parents' house and there'd still be food on the table.
Exactly.
And everything.
And not having kids. I think when you have kids, it's so much more risk and so much harder. There's people counting on you.
You look at the people who start businesses when they're in their 40s or 50s and they're like, all right, well, I'm mortgaging the house and I've got kids that are relying on me and I'm going to start a business. That's real risk taking, because there, if you stuff that up.
You can't stay up all night anymore, which you used to be able to.
They're the real ones. It's like all of the entrepreneurs who have a crack when they're in their mid-20s. Great. Wonderful. More and more should do it, because that's a time in your life when you should be having a crack.
To invest in yourself. That is like, and if you fail, it's like a business lesson, a business course. Did your parents give you any pressures to be like, you know, as an immigrant family, to be like the doctor, lawyer, all that kind of stuff?
Doctor, lawyer was the starting position. Mm-hmm. And I remember my dad cut his finger once. Him and I were working on something in the backyard and I lost the plot. I saw the blood and I was like, I couldn't handle it. And I'm like, oh, I'm running around. But my mum goes to my grandma, it's like, I don't think he's going to be a doctor.
Oh, my God.
And my grandma's like, no, he'll grow out of it. Don't worry, he'll grow out of it. And to this day, it's like I see a little bit of blood, I lose the plot.
If someone goes, oh, no, she's not going to be a doctor, someone else is like, don't say it, you'll jinx it. Yeah. You'll make it true. Like, oh, my God, that's not how any of those things work.
So even when I started the business, because I, you know, did pretty well at uni and I had a good education and a good corporate job and I was earning decent money in the corporate job, my mum was crying because she's like, you're giving up all of this to be a TV salesman.
Oh.
And it was like, so, you know, they're not easy to please, these immigrant parents.
My mum was like, I remember I had a little store. She's like, but you're a shop assistant. Because we're immigrants. Sorry, I don't mean to like put down the profession, but they were like, you had a corporate job. And anyway.
Because you are a shop assistant, but at scale. You can be like, but I'm a shop assistant of like, imagine if you took this store and imagined it as a physical, it's huge.
Yeah.
And so it's like they didn't understand the digital element, the digital element of what's going on. And then I remember I made it a bit of a success at the start, but she was still worried. And she's like, yeah, so I was thinking, what happens once everyone gets a TV? Because our first products were just two TVs. And she thought, well, everyone's going to buy a TV and that's the end of the business. And I'm like, don't worry, there'll be the next thing and the next thing.
But also, if everyone buys a TV from you, you'd be sweet.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah. From there, were you entrepreneurial as a kid?
Yeah. So always, you know, started a car wash business as one of my first when I was young. So was selling golf balls back to golfers, website design business as soon as we got dial-up modems.
Wow. And
things like that. So always having a crack at something and trying to look at the market and say, well, what is a trend? What doesn't exist that should exist? And iterating from there.
I was never entrepreneurial. I wasn't even that person that would like, when the DVD came out, you could burn it, you could make money. I wasn't even like, I feel like that was a good segue.
So Shopo, your first...
I had a pop-up store that failed, which led into this. And I just jumped on someone else's idea. I just never even saw a future of like not working for someone. But we both had a corporate background. You worked at Accenture. And this is another point of your story that really like resonated with me. But I'll let you tell it.
It's an interesting place. I'm sure there's a lot of people building a really good career at Accenture. And there's a certain personality type that it suits. But for me, it was sort of like the McDonald's of really smart people where they had a really good recruitment program, really smart grads, capable of lots of things, but a fairly tight process in which they had to go and work for clients. And essentially, you know, they're paying you low salary and then selling you to the big corporations
Like when you first saw your charge out rate? Because I was at KPMG and you're like, what? I mean, it's also, I didn't really understand how margins worked.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that. Like, oh, yeah, but they're paying for this office and building and blah, blah, blah.
All the overheads are but it's still pretty crazy. It's like, well, I'm costing them $35 an hour and they're
getting paid 10. Yeah. I was at the time getting paid 10, 20 and they were charging 200.
Like, exactly. So it's like, I'm costing them 35, they're getting 400, whatever it is. It's like, it's a huge margin. Yeah. But yeah, they've got a lot of overhead for it. But it also changes the incentive structure. So one of the things that really set me back in that corporate environment is I was coming up with all these ideas that didn't fit the framework. And the ideas were about efficiency. The ideas were like, hey, we've got this bit of work that's going to take us 1,000 hours. I think I've got an idea on how we can do it in 100 hours. And I was getting pushed back. Now I realize why I was getting pushback. It's not that the managers didn't like me or didn't like the ideas. It's that the managers would rather charge out 1,000 hours, not 100 hours.
Right. Oh, my God. Yeah.
But, you know, it causes that sort of incentive structure. Yeah. So here I am as a young, really enthusiastic corporate worker wanting to make a difference, coming up with all these ideas and being told, no, we won't do that. Why? We won't do it. Go back to
the desk. Their butt off to engage for the engagement fees and the hours negotiated. They don't need you
to
ruin it.
They've got a set number of hours. They're not interested in efficiency. They're interested in billable hours.
Yes.
you know, that really caused, it was disheartening. And the beautiful thing with it is, was that it was so disheartening that it probably had a big impact in me starting my own business. I wasn't enjoying work and then had the idea for this business. And within a few days, it was up and running and I had quit Accenture. How that happened was I was looking to buy a TV, and even though I had a pretty good job, this is back in 2006. So flat screen TVs were the new thing and they cost a lot of money. It was like $5,000 for a TV. And then so I thought, I can't afford one from the big shops. I'd always been a bit of a tech geek and been importing mobile phones from overseas because that's where they came out first. And so I thought, let me contact a few factories and ask them for a quote on 10,000 TVs with this specification. So I went and emailed these leading factory manufacturers of TVs, asked them for a big order of TVs. They started to come back with prices. My initial thought was, once they do that, I'll ask for a sample. And that sample will be my TV.
Right.
And that will be, and I would have managed to get the latest tech for really cheap.
Brilliant.
But once they started coming back with the quotes, I'm like, hang on a second. I can land a TV for $1,000 that the big name stores are selling for $5,000. And I've just been to Miami where I finished off my uni degree there and I saw the rise of online retail. And I'm like, this could be a really good product for online retail. You've got a thin box with a lot of value in it. I thought, yeah. So I went and built the website and started the business and then quit Accenture.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was all within the space of a few days.
Wow. Did you get 10,000 units?
No, it was.
How did you get the funding?
There was no funding. I started a pre-sale. I put it up on the website and I knew that to manufacture, they said, takes about 30 days. Shipping takes about 15 days. So I was like, we'll be delivered in 45 days. And I started a pre-sale and I started also selling them 1 cent no reserve on eBay because I knew that as long as two people want a TV.
Supply and demand.
Yeah, yeah. It'll get the right price. It's like a house. You know, you see a house auction start for $1 million and it ends at $1.1 million. Mm. If you started that auction for at $1, it would still sell for 1.1 mil. Could even probably sell for more than 1.1 mil because it would generate a lot of hype and attention. It would be someone's selling a house for a dollar. Yeah. So I was selling TVs for 1 cent, no reserve, daily listing, selling lots of TVs, selling lots through the website. Interestingly, because the website was relatively unknown at that stage, very often the 1 cent no reserve listing on eBay would sell for a higher price than
you could just buy it
on the website, or nobody knew the website.
Right.
So it had very little traffic. Yeah. People would be bidding more thinking, these things cost $5,000 at a big name store. And here we are. I'm going to bid $1,500 or $2,000.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
$1,000.
Hey,
Hey Potty fam, I've got something special for you. For a limited time only, I have a discount code for my business course. In case you didn't know, the course is a blueprint for starting an online business and growing it to 7 or 8 figures. It's 10 modules of videos that you can watch at your own pace, covering everything from sourcing product, growing and developing your product range, operations, and marketing and scaling your business. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout at thelazyceo.com. What kind of prices did you like?
It'd vary. I was making very decent margin, but I was selling them. It was around $1,500 at the time.
Did you have to pay $10,000 pre-order?
No, so I couldn't sell $10,000. Yeah. When I went to the factory and I said, the pre-sales showed me that, hey, there's demand here, there's a business. So then I go to confirm the order with the factory. And I was a bit ignorant at the time. I hadn't done much business with China. And I'd go to the factory. I'm like, look, I know you gave me a price for 10,000 units. I want to do an order of 80 TVs, which was going to be one container. And go, I understand if the price will be a little bit more for 80 units. And they reply laughing at me. They're like, look, to run set up a production line costs us a lot of money. And to manufacture 80 TVs does not make economic sense for us. We can't do 80. You have to order 10,000, basically go away.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh no, what do I do now? I've pre-sold a few TVs already. The supplier's telling me they don't actually want to supply me anymore. I can smell that there's a really good business opportunity here. I've got the demand. I've got the customers. That's the hardest bit. How do I convince this factory to accept my order? Then it hit me because one thing I learned at Accenture is how to make a beautiful Western style document, a beautiful PowerPoint presentation with all the nice images and diagrams and all of that. The Chinese factories were brilliant at manufacturing and they had all the latest equipment and machinery in their factories to make high quality products. But if you looked at their sales material and the marketing material and the user manuals, it was in broken English. A lot of it didn't make sense. It wasn't great. It was like lots of different fonts. And
it's a very different style of marketing from China and Australia.
And so they weren't very good at all of that. So I stayed up for a few nights and redid all of that for them. And I said, look, I can't add value in placing a massive order, but I can help your business in other ways. And I sent them all of this work that I'd done. I redid all of their marketing brochures, pricing spreadsheets, and all of that.
You didn't negotiate that in. You're like, here it is.
I just did it to show them the value I can add because I was desperate. Like I needed, it was the best move I could come up with. They replied immediately saying, thank you so much for what you've done. They accepted my small order of 80 TVs. And they gave me a better price than we had agreed on a 10,000 TV order. So basically, they saw huge value in the work that I had done for them, which they were not capable of doing themselves. So I guess the business lesson there is always look for a win-win and make sure that every engagement, every interaction is a win-win interaction. They actually emailed me a few weeks after that saying they just won a massive customer in the US who said they were by far the most professional factory they had encountered. So
that's amazing.
Showed that it was managed to provide value in that way. They accepted the order and then fulfilled that. And I sold those 80 TVs, made a bit of profit, which then meant that all the customers were really happy. Reviews online started popping up. More traffic to the site started popping up. I made a bit of profit, which meant I could already prepay for the next order and it didn't have to be a 45-day. It could be a 30-day pre-sale, then a 15-day pre-sale. And then we started to have TVs in the warehouse and be able to deliver next day and things like that. So that's how it started and gained traction.
Wow. What was the biggest challenge to get everything up and running once you've sold those 80 units?
There are challenges all throughout. We were building a brand that's competing in a massive market with some of the most cashed up competitors out there. So, you know, we're competing with Australia's biggest retailers. There's only two or three places in Australia you can go to buy consumer electronics, and they're multi-billion dollar companies spending hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing. So I'm competing with the retailers, but then I'm also competing with the manufacturers, essentially. So your Samsungs, LGs, Sonys, who are spending billions and billions of dollars on marketing and ads on TV with multicolored bouncing balls and like just all of this really emotional brand building stuff. So the competitors had really, really deep pockets.
Yeah.
And here I am going, hey, I can deliver a lot of value to customers, but I don't have a marketing budget. Everything is bootstrapped. We're relying on growing organically. There was no investment. It wasn't like I went to investors who said, oh, this will work. Here's money. I went to investors saying what I'm going to do. And they're like, oh, as if anyone's going to buy a TV online. Online's for books and CDs.
Right.
And, so no one was interested. So it was literally having to be profitable from day one and funding the business through cash flow. And I guess that led to us needing to shout loudly and proudly about what we're doing and win customers through word of mouth and other tactics to get attention.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you did? I definitely like lived through the whole like Kogan brand growing and being everywhere. Like what are some of the things you did?
The biggest thing I'd say that helped us along is word of mouth. So a TV is like a showpiece purchase in a house. So it was, especially at the time when there was a transition to flat screen TVs, it's like now you walk into someone's house, there's five TVs in there. You don't really notice them. You'd have no idea. But this is back at a time when people had those big chunky CRT TVs. And every now and then you walk into someone's house and now they've got a beautiful flat screen TV. Mm-hmm. So it was always a talking point thing. Yeah. So people who bought a Kogan TV, firstly, anyone came over to their house, it's like, oh, you got a TV. And then they're like, yeah.
Can not you only believe the price?
Yeah, yeah. Not only did I get a TV, wait till you see the price. So we were getting a lot of like, oh, I've come to Kogan because I saw it at my friend's house or a friend told me about it.
You know Friends, the show?
Yeah.
I love this moment where like Joey walks into this, like they're talking about how like this house had no TV. And then Joey goes, but what direction do all of their furniture point towards? It's like, it is a centerpiece of the house.
It's exactly right. So it's probably less of a centerpiece now
nowadays,
because now TVs are so cheap. Everyone's got five TVs in there. But back then,
and laptops there was and screens, phones,
So that helped us a lot. Another one would be realizing very early on, we were an innovative business that was breaking through ground on quite a different way to sell stuff in a big industry. We had a big story to tell, and that journalists need content just as much as we needed attention. It's a quid pro quo, essentially. So making myself available to every journo who wanted to call and ask about retail or tech or the latest trends or operating systems or hardware or China or supply chains or anything like that. So there was a period where there was a lot of attention on our business during the time when we needed it most.
Mm-hmm.
And then also leveraging the fact that we're a challenger brand, we're the consumer champion. Where they're in an established big industry doing something differently, challenging the status quo. Every consumer champion has an enemy. That gives your platform to tell your story. If you know, Subway's enemy was McDonald's. Wherever there was McDonald's, Subway would open up and talk about being healthier than McDonald's. Apple's enemy when they were a consumer champion brand was Microsoft and IBM. It's like Uber's enemy was the taxi. Every challenger consumer champion brand has an incumbent enemy. And if they can tell their
disruptor.
Story, they can tell their story and be the consumer champion, that works very well. Every now and then you can poke and poke and poke and poke your enemy and get a reaction from them.
And what have you done?
It causes amazing attention. For us, that was one of Australia's greatest retailers and entrepreneurs, being Gerry Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
He's transformed the retail landscape over decades, built an incredible, massive business. In our view, does things the old way. We think that if we look forward 10, 20, 30 years, things will be done more like the way Kogan does it rather than the way that business does it. But still, they'd been around for a while. They were the incumbent. They were the enemy to poke. I was one day filming a Today Tonight episode. It was about these new Kogan TVs we were launching. I deployed a strategy that I had heard about through following Eminem through college and high school and a battle that Eminem had with Ja Rule.
Right.
So I remember there was a period when Ja Rule and Eminem were having a battle and I'd go online and I'd download what Eminem said about Ja Rule and then what Ja Rule said about Eminem and then vice versa. And it's like for a while I'm following this and downloading their stuff Eminem then ended it by saying, I'm not going to reply anymore because I've sold you more records than you could ever sell yourself. And I thought, interesting. I'd always listen to Eminem. I never listened to Ja Rule. All of a sudden, they're battling. So Ja Rule's occupying my mind space and I'd never even listened to him before. So I was like, I need Jerry to respond to me. So when we're filming this Today Tonight episode and the cameras were off, I'm telling the journal, I'm like, hey, if Jerry saw these prices, he would go nuts. You will need a defibrillator. Like, he will not be happy. He will not be happy if he sees these prices. Don't show it to him. You know, I'm sort of being like the kid in the play yard provoking a fight, being, oh, do you hear what he said about your mum? You know, like, we're watching that episode of Today Tonight in the office later that night. There's our team. There was like 10 of us at the time, a few pizzas. We're watching Today Tonight, watching the live traffic on our website. And there you have Jerry Harvey holding a printout of our website saying, oh, their prices aren't that cheap. They're only $200 cheaper on this model and they're only $300 cheaper on this model.
He took the bait,
responded, and then the media just blew it up from there. I offered, it was during an election, so I offered a live debate with Jerry Harvey about online retail. He refused the debate. That blew it up a bit further. And then you had this whole massive cycle of Kogan versus Harvey Norman. We were doing like $10 million revenue at the time. Harvey Norman was doing $4, $5 billion revenue. Yeah. We were just a little pimple on the butt of the industry and, you know, completely irrelevant. However, in the media landscape, it was Kogan versus Harvey Norman.
Wow.
You know, a media perspective, we did what we had to do. We had to get grand fame for our business, tell our story, explain our value offering to customers without a marketing budget.
Oh, that's so amazing watching them like take the bait.
Yeah,
thank
you, Eminem, and thank you for seeing fights provoked in the schoolyard at school where people, you know.
Oh, my God, I love it. Hey, Potty fam, I had too many questions to ask Ruslan, so this is going to have to spill over to part two. In the next part, we talk about how to get PR and get attention and how his fight with Jerry Harvey was a clever tactic that grew the business, how he became overstocked post-COVID and how he overcame it, and growing additional income streams using the subscription model. All right, see you in part two. Okay, that's it from me for now. Thanks for listening. And if you're loving the podcast, don't forget to leave us a review. And if you want more, join the conversation on the podcast Instagram at thelazyceo_podcast. Link to the show notes. Catch you next Tuesday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.